From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Spices. We use them every day to give our food character and identity. But what about the character and identity of the spices themselves and the people who initially nurtured them and used them? The spice trade was a blueprint for colonization and capitalism, but the spices themselves are this magical gift that brings together nature, culture, flavor, and tradition. If you want to witness the resilience of culture and of community, just follow how spices, and in particular spice blends, travel with diasporas across the globe. For centuries, spices were a critical component in healing. And Professor David Shorter is trying to document this history as the director of the Archive of Healing at UCLA. The collection aims to preserve indigenous knowledge, and it includes hundreds of thousands of entries, much of which involve food. Hello, Professor Shorter.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I guess we should start off with this question. What is the Archive of Healing, Ritual, and Transformation?
Well, the archive started as a means for a previous professor at the university to collect sayings, colloquialisms. We used to call them folk tales. There's a very gendered way to say it, which is old wives' tales. Things that people used to talk about that were related to healing or health or wellness or curing. And so he was really documenting things like incantations, folk tales about, you know, perhaps kissing, you know, at adolescence. But within this process, he actually started collecting information about not just spices, food ways, rituals, these ways that I guess in a broader sense, I've come to call the Archive of Healing rather than something that they previously called something like traditional medicine.
What is the time span and the geographical reach of the materials in the archive?
The materials were collected from published sources as well as university archives and then from anthropological field notes. So depending on when the source was covering its own material, we have materials that date back to the 1700s and 1800s because that was the oral tradition that was being collected by the anthropologist at the time. A lot of the published materials come from the early 1900s. If you do a search, for example, by geography, like Southern California, there were a lot of people collecting information from communities between 1920 and 1950. So there, of course, there are gaps. And then there's also a large amount from particular moments in time.
How did you get involved?
I got involved when I received a phone call from a librarian at the University of California, Los Angeles, who said that they had found this archive of material and that they did not know if the database was of use anymore and that it hadn't really been used much. In fact, it was on a server that was called a cold server, meaning that they didn't know if anyone ever actually went to the links anymore. I looked at that and I was blown away. This was unbelievable. And this was in 2012. I started asking myself, well, how can this material be protected first and foremost? And then also, how can we open it up to be a living archive, one that people contribute to as well as learn from?
Can you speak to your awareness that the data in the archive was not what we would now call neutral and it was somewhat free-floating, that it had been, in fact, taken from somewhere, from someone?
That may be the most important question that I was wrestling with. A lot of people have asked me what my research has been over the last decade, and it's not at all what I thought it would be. This, in some ways, captivated me. It took me away from what I thought I'd be doing because of this central question of what is data? Who does data belong to? Who has the right to benefit from data? I think we often think of data in terms of quantitative or numerical terms rather than the communities that actually provided some anthropologist or some ethnographer this information. So if you ask me what I've been doing for the last 9 years, I've been having students and colleagues and advisory board members and myself, we've been going through hundreds and thousands of data points and asking ourselves, do we know where this data came from? Do we know how this data was taken? And is there a way for the life of the archive to exist in such a manner that we can benefit those particular communities?
So how do the materials in the archive allow us to investigate our collective identities or a specific heritage?
The amazing aspect for me as a person who's seen hundreds and hundreds of people request access to the archive on a daily basis is just simply the geography from where these people are asking for accounts from. All over Europe, all over North Africa, all over Latin America, people are asking for accounts. And I have to say, the really interesting aspect as the director is to see how that is a mirror reflection of the data that's actually in the archive. If a person were to go into the Archive of Healing and put in something as simple as clove, which is a common spice that many people have inside their kitchen, they might be surprised to see that clove was a common approach to fixing a toothache. The thing that's amazing to me, and I think that a lot of people, for example, academic researchers or people who are interested in the culinary arts might find, is that clove was an approach to toothaches in Ireland, in London, in Nova Scotia, in Cleveland, in Amsterdam, North Carolina, Sicily, I mean, Spanish-speaking communities of New Mexico, Santa Clara, California. I mean, how did this become an approach to thinking about a spice that's in everyone's kitchen that has a very close, you might want to say, sister to what we think of as wellness or healing or approaches to health?
So obviously on this show, food is at the center of what we do and how we look at the world. We have, from the beginning of Good Food, had a pretty strict policy around not covering what I would call health claims. Mm-hmm. And yet the spice cabinet that we use today sits squarely at this intersection of history and culture, and what I guess you would call traditional wellness before it got co-opted by marketing brands and capitalism. Mm-hmm. So I would love to talk to you about this push to decolonize our diets and pantries.
I am familiar with the decolonize your diet movement. I teach a class on seemingly unrelated to the Archive of Healing, which is about colonization and how people are responding to colonization. One of the materials that we've looked at in that class is this book called Decolonize Your Diet, Plant-Based Mexican-American Recipes for Health and Healing, written by Professors Luz Calvo and Catriona Rueda Esquivel. And they were trying to better understand how what we call Mexican cuisine dates back from practices around food, thinking about the creation of what we might call a recipe from pre-Hispanic times in Mexico. And I think that you look at the ways that food systems or diets can be colonized, you run the gamut of political movements. You're looking at the ways that there are food deserts in particularly Southern California, or we might say those places where it's becoming very impossible to get healthy food for some people. But you're also looking at people who are just simply trying to ask questions. And I think this is more related to the Archive of Healing, which is what herbs or spices were used in particular cultures for what particular reasons. And without going into a claim about this is FDA approved or whether this is something that the Archive of Healing is giving its stamp of approval for, you can start seeing inside the archive that this Mexican spice that some people don't really use a lot, my family actually did, called epazote. Epazote was used in pre-Hispanic times as an antispasmatic, or it actually beat fungal infections. And one of these things that I think the Decolonize Your Diet movement can do is it can help us understand that there were knowledge bases and there were ways of sharing knowledge that have been disrupted through the colonization process. And so you don't have to subscribe to a wholesale, we need to revamp the entire food system of the United States to at least get some of the benefits from what it means to decolonize a diet.
It must be so fascinating for your students to start to dig in. What are some of the conversations that have emerged?
One of the benefits from the classes that I'm seeing students walk away from is the classic college experience of just opening your mind to histories you didn't know about. A lot of women were pushed out of the knowledge sharing community in Europe and were then labeled witches. And those alleged witches were sharing information in places that we call gardens. And they were sharing information that we might call, in some ways, about the pharmacy of the community, ways of helping their children or their relatives. And to learn that those people were pushed out of knowledge sharing practices and that that continued into the beginning of what we call American history, that's something that right on the very beginning, most of the students walk away from not knowing. I think that a lot of people did not know that these recipes or simple dishes that you might want to say, like, you know, a mole from Mexico, actually had properties that we can now look as, wow, that was actually good for the body. It's not just good for your sense of identity. It was actually good for your health. And I think that that's something that a lot of people are now taking back to their families and asking their parents and their grandparents, hey, can you teach me that dish that I loved or that, you know, that recipe that I loved as a kid? And then they start collecting those stories.
Very powerful. Is there any other individual spice or food you'd like to tell us a story about?
I keep coming back to one that was interesting in my household. So I grew up at the apron strings of my mother and my great-grandmother. And due to whatever reason, I was often at home watching them cook. And my great-grandmother was a sort of woman who had a garden in the back, and she had people come to her house, and she would prepare tinctures or potions or teas for them from her garden and talk to them for hours. And one of the things I really loved about my great-grandmother is before there were certification processes early in the 1900s in New Mexico, she was like a midwife. I'm not saying a certified midwife, but she had, you might want to say, clients. And her cooking was unbelievable. And I tried for years, once I got to college, to start perfecting some of these dishes she made. And she made this stew that many people know as pozole. And I didn't understand why hers tasted so differently than all the ones that I tried in restaurants. And I found out from my aunt that, oh, grandma, she used epazote, which is literally translates to, like, from the Aztec word stinkweed. It's a really pungent, you might want to say, herb. And when I started looking into how epazote traveled across Latin America and what people were using it for, and how different preparations lead for it to have different effects on the human body, it just blew my mind. Because what we're then recognizing are not these, you know, plants, these inanimate objects sitting in our gardens, but they start to become personalities. They start to have characteristics that you recognize, not just by sight, but by the finer senses, like taste and palate. And also now I'm starting to think that some of these plant relatives, they're like the people that we can go to for help with our health as well. So for me, being a foodie, I just love, of course, anything that, you know, has to do with digestion and nutrition, all these different aspects of food. And healing is now being brought to the table.
Thank you so much, Professor. What an interesting conversation.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you for having me on.
That was UCLA Professor David Shorter talking about the Archive of Healing, Ritual, and Transformation. We'll have a link. Coming up, when Goya Foods president Robert Unanue came out in support of the Trump administration, many in the Latinx community felt betrayed and began looking elsewhere for their sazon. How that shot one New York-based spice company into the limelight. Next.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food. I found that when it comes to spices, often just the mention of a particular blend can fire up my inspiration to cook something more often or even for the first time. A relatively new Latinx entrant into my spice cabinet. I learned about the brand in 2020 when the president of Goya Foods, long a juggernaut in Latinx pantries, praised Donald Trump at a White House press conference in the Rose Garden. Latinx families felt betrayed, and the reaction was swift and loud. Boycott Goya was trending on Twitter, which turned out to be a boon for Scott Hattis. Scott is one of four partners at Luisa, who together blend their Dominican and Peruvian heritage and New York City roots to create a totally new sazon and adobo. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
What does Luisa mean?
Louisa is a name based off of a neighborhood in New York, the Lower East Side. And in Spanglish, and also on the street signs there, you'll see it says Loisida. And that's where my wife and I lived when we started the business, and we thought it just elicited a great feeling and emotion and sort of the vibrancy we wanted to bring to this brand.
So let's talk about the spices. What are sazon and adobo, and how are they used?
So sazon and adobo are kind of like your pantry staples in sort of any Latin kitchen. They're both seasoning blends. We use only organic spices and sea salt, and they're wonderful together. They're wonderful apart. Traditionally, sazon is kind of a richer, more color-oriented blend that you would bring in and cook deep into sort of beans and rices and stewed dishes, right? But we also now, we mix it often with a bit of olive oil and spread it over veggies or tofu, or it's wonderful with fish. So really, it's a richer, deeper flavor and super versatile as well. The adobo is kind of like your all-purpose Latin seasoning sort of salt replacement blend. Not that it's incredibly salty, but that it can be used sort of as you would see some salt-oriented blends in other cuisines use. So this is an incredible thing to use as part of a marinade, as a dry rub, anything from your proteins to your veggies again as well. But we personally keep it next to the stovetop. It finds its way into almost at least a meal a day, whether that's a tofu scramble in the morning or again, veggies at night.
Can you give us an idea of what some of the spices are in each one so we understand how they're different?
For sure. So in the sazon, it's the main spices you'd find and we use are achiote or annatto. We have cumin as well, coriander, garlic, oregano, and black pepper. That's all we use along with sea salt. In our blend, I think the cumin and the achiote, they certainly come to the forefront in that color, and the sort of dusty, earthiness of that is certainly what separates the sazon from the adobo. But of course, you're having that oregano and garlic come through as well, and just a little bit of pepper, if that paints a picture for you.
And what about the adobo?
So in the adobo, we use garlic, turmeric, black pepper, and oregano along with sea salt. The visual of it is more like a dry rub, somewhat more granular pieces, less ground and dusty. And, you know, I would say the garlic and the oregano come out a lot in this. I think we have some really good sourced organic versions of each. And the turmeric is maybe a little different for some people, but this is where we really are trying to include ingredients that also have some added benefit. You wouldn't always find turmeric in the adobo, but we think it brings a beautiful color to dishes, which we think is super important in terms of the appetizing side of it, but also the antioxidant benefits that, you know, make it a popular spice right now.
So I know that you opened before the Goya scandal, we could say, went crazy. But maybe you could talk a little bit about why you and your partners felt the need to create a spice business when there was this huge monolith company that sort of sucked up all the air in that sector.
In many ways, that is the reason we felt there was a need to create this business. You know, based on our backgrounds and beliefs, it just came to us as, you know, we're close friends and we enjoy meals together, at least until the past year and, you know, and change with COVID. But we used to cook all the time, and this idea came from those shared meals and us starting families. Both of us have young children. And discussing together, like, how important these foods and flavors are in our homes and how we're not going to serve, you know, what Goya is making to our family. So if we want something better, you know, maybe, you know, we can go out and create that. And maybe there's a lot of people who feel the same we do. So the idea, though, that a company that big is not taking advantage of the ability to innovate and make better products for people, but continuing to sell something that is filled with fillers, with, you know, sort of artificial flavors and colors that have been tied to health issues. And, you know, the fact that we were able to go create a business that had products that did not include those as two people, not a, you know, gigantic, big Latin food business is what we kind of say, is a testament to the fact that there's a choice that's there. And there's a choice on a business standpoint, and there's a choice on a customer and community standpoint. And, you know, we all along wanted to present a better choice.
Scott, can you describe what it was that happened that put Goya in a different light?
Yes. So the CEO spoke out in favor and support of the Trump administration, which is obviously a sort of tense stance to take up against a community of customers who have been quite adversely affected by that administration and its policies. And I can say that in my home and with my wife and our family, it was an incredibly emotional moment because these are products that have been in my wife's family and her home her whole life, and now my family and my home for 15 plus years. And the memories around family get-togethers and holidays and like her papi cooking his rice with all these products started to suddenly take on a bit of a different feeling. And I think that as much as the politics, this idea of this, in many ways, a rug being pulled out from under your feet. And, you know, people dress up as Goya Sazón for Halloween. I mean, this is a iconic part of a culture. And when something is so blatantly thrown back in your face, so to speak, it was a crazy moment in our home because the amount of attention our business got in those, the first 24, 36, 48 hours was keeping everyone incredibly busy. But it was also really emotional and personal. And I think that is what was unique about this. This wasn't a Volkswagen talking about their diesel fuels in a wrong way. This was a culturally tied brand that had been in homes and was in homes. And there's a deeper sentiment attached to that.
Well, thank you so much, Scott. So interesting.
I appreciate that. And thank you for having me on. It's wonderful to share about what we're trying to do here.
That was Scott Hattis, co-founder of Luisa, along with his wife, Anna, Kenny Luna, and Yadira Garcia. I would wager that a majority of Americans have a 6-ounce square yellow, red, and blue tin of Old Bay in their spice rack. Ever present at seafood boils and crab shacks, it sure was news to me that the man behind this iconic blend is a concentration camp survivor. Leah Seesfeld wrote about it for The Nosher and is here to tell us his incredible story. Hi, Leah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give us a bit of backstory on Gustav Brun? Tell us a bit about his early years and how he got started in the spice world.
Sure. Brun was born in the 1890s in the town of Bastheim in southeast Germany. He grew up in a poor family, and when he was about a teenager, he had to quit school because it was too expensive, and he began working as a tannery apprentice. In the 1920s, when the economy was tanking, the tannery closed, but there was still a market for spices. And Brun actually began selling sausage cases and spice blends specific for the sausages to sausage makers. And that was the beginning of his career.
So then there was the rise of Hitler. And to save his business, Brun moved to Frankfurt and not soon after applied for a visa to the United States. Can you explain Kristallnacht and how it affected the spice maker?
Sure. So Kristallnacht, which is also known as the Night of Broken Glass, November 9th, 1938, was an unprecedented pogrom that was a massive, violent attack that destroyed synagogues, Jewish businesses, and schools. It was sort of this like signal of Nazi escalation. And the day after, on the radio, they called for all Jews to surrender their firearms. And Bruin happened to be an avid hunter. So he complied. And when he went, they told him that he actually wasn't going to be able to leave. And within hours, he was taken to Buchenwald concentration camp.
How did he manage to get out?
So this is kind of crazy. He was only in there for 2 weeks, which really I have never heard of someone just being in a concentration camp for just 2 weeks. And as it happens, there was some lawyer in Frankfurt who was known in the Jewish community, and his wife arranged his early release through this lawyer who bribed the Gestapo, which are the secret police of Nazi Germany, for 10,000 marks. And I was reading that apparently this was something that happened, I guess, very rarely at the beginning, but I really had never heard of anything like this before.
So he is able to escape Germany with his family. Where did they end up settling?
So they end up settling in Baltimore.
And did he immediately find work in the spice trade?
So it took him a while to find work. But finally, he did land a job at McCormick & Company, which was and still is the world's biggest spice maker. And then just after a few days of working there, they found out that he was Jewish and they fired him.
So when he left, did he immediately set up shop for himself?
It was in 1939. So he left Germany in 1938. So it was within that year. He was at McCormick, he got fired, and he opened his own store. So I imagine it all did happen pretty quickly.
And this is a time when I would imagine a lot of spices are never actually put in jars, but people come in and ask for different blends, and spice merchants would probably just fold them up in a little corner of newspaper and hand them to people. Was he in an area where there are a lot of seafood vendors?
Yes. His store that he opened, the Baltimore Spice Company, was actually right across from this bustling fish market. So people would come in and he would notice, he would take note of what they asked for, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that's how Old Bay came to be.
How many spices are in the blend? And what do we know that it includes?
So they say that it's a blend of 18 herbs and spices. Not all 18 of them are known. What we do know is that it includes mustard seed, paprika, celery salt, mace, nutmeg, cinnamon, bay leaf, red pepper, cardamom, celery seed, clove, salt, pepper, and ginger. But that's only 14. So there are 4 secret ingredients.
And bay leaves? Are bay leaves in there?
Oh, yes. Yes, bay leaves.
And how did the name come about?
So Bruin actually had a friend in advertising who suggested Old Bay seafood seasoning after the Old Bay line, which was a well-known Baltimore steamship company.
And did McCormick ever come back into this story?
Yes. So McCormick kind of keeps coming back into the story. So at first, they became intimidated by the increased popularity that Old Bay was having in Baltimore, and they copied the tin packaging. And then when Old Bay got even more successful and Bruin attempted to join the American Spice Trade Association, McCormick threatened to leave. And then over the years, McCormick tried to buy the Old Bay brand, but Bruin rejected every bid because he had this bad taste in his mouth from his experience there.
And who owns Old Bay now?
McCormick.
Well, it's such a great story. It's so totally unexpected.
Right? And it's so ironic, too, because shellfish is not kosher.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Leah.
Thank you.
That was Leah Seasfeld. To read her story about the Jewish roots of Old Bay for the Nosher, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, the tart tang of red sumac. If you're a sour nut like me, then it's a flavor you won't want to live without. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Last week on the show, we heard from Anas Atassi about his favorite ways to break the fast during Ramadan. This week, he returns, and we zoom in on one of my favorite flavors, sumac. It's the title of his new book. I spoke to Anas at 10 p.m. his time in Amsterdam on the first night of Ramadan. Hi, Anas.
Hey, Evan.
So you named the book Sumak. You call it the red thread. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so Sumak, first of all, it's like a really lovely, has a lovely deep red color. And it is has a tangy taste, more like a kind of citrusy. The reason why I call it like the red thread is because like how versatile is sumac. So sumac, you can really use it in so many dishes. So my book starts, of course, from the breakfast until the dessert. So all the way along from kind of breakfast dishes into the soups, the salads, the meat, the red meat, and also the fish and the chicken dishes. Like the addition of sumac just elevates the dish and gives it a very lovely taste, even to an extent that sometimes I also use sumac on top of popcorn. So if you would put sumac on top of popcorn, trust me, you will not miss your caramel popcorn.
Before sumac is ground, what does it look like?
Sumac is actually a type of berry. It usually grows on a tree, and this berry is dried. And after it's dried, they ground it and keeps it a bit coarse, not so much powdery, but a bit of more structure into it.
And it adds such a, not only this incredible lemony taste, but it's so beautiful. It's this deep kind of brick red.
Exactly. It's like really distinct color that you cannot miss it. And what I really like about it is not only like the fact that it's so distinct appearance-wise, but it's also so distinct for the region, the taste of the region of Syria, but also the Levant area in general.
So let's just talk a little bit about how you grew up. I know that you were raised in Saudi Arabia for the most part, but your family would go back to Syria, to Homs, every summer. Could you talk a little bit about how you remember food entering your life as a child?
Indeed. So I grew up in... I was actually born in Syria and then was exported directly to Saudi, where my parents were working. And I grew up in Syria, in Saudi, with the Syrian food and the Syrian food tradition. I don't recall a day where my mom haven't cooked a single Syrian dish. Like it's maybe most of the time always for breakfast, lunch and dinner. And every now and then she would add some kind of a non-Syrian dish. But also what I really find it fascinating when I went back to Syria during the 3-month summer holidays that we would spend there, that I've kind of also experienced the lovely other perspectives of Syrian food, especially the street food of my city, Homs. Such a rich culture of especially my city, but also many other cities in Syria are very much well known for their street food and also the culture around how, when and how is it eaten.
I know that as a child, you were allowed to kind of run free with your cousins and your siblings. And so what were some of these treats that you would get on the street?
Yes. So one of my favorite dishes growing up, it's called toshka. Toshka is actually more common in Aleppo, but people from Homs, they just love it quite a lot. And there is one really great place, actually under the grandmother of my mom's house, and where we used to, me and my cousin, anytime we have the chance to run away from family gathering or when we are let alone and our parents were engaged in a an adult only kind of no children allowed weddings or celebration, we would run away to this toshka place. It's basically a flat bread with heavily spiced meat and a gooey melted cheese in, And it's like you toast it like a panini between two flat breads. And just so lovely with the garlic sauce.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. So let's talk some more about spices. When I think about Syrian food, I also think about za'atar and the difference between the red and the green. Can you explain it to us?
Yes. So there is quite some variety of za'atars. And also, like, each za'atar shop has their own type of blends into za'atar. But there is, like, I think the one of the most common za'atars, especially in the Western world where they experience za'atar, is usually the green za'atar. And this is basically made of thyme and sumac mainly, and sesame seeds, of course. And this is originally actually coming from Palestine, Jordan area. This area is very much famous for this green za'atar. But actually in Syria, we do eat this za'atar, but we also have a much more, much more complicated za'atar, which has almost like 11 ingredients into it, including like fennel seed, anise, watermelon seed, also coriander seeds, pomegranate seeds. Of course, on top of it, the thyme, and of course, sesame seed. So it's a really mix of hearty, earthy flavors. It's such, so amazing.
And do you have a recipe for that? Do you make it yourself, or have you found somewhere where you can buy it?
Actually, I haven't found any place where I can buy it. And I only know my grandmother who can do it so perfectly. So I get shipped premium za'atar from Homs, made by my grandmother every now and then.
So all of these seeds, like the watermelon seed, coriander, everything, are they ground and then mixed together, or are they left whole?
No, they're ground until they're really fine. So it's like almost like a powder altogether. And then you add the sesame seeds on it with the mix.
And what is it used for?
So it's exactly used like the za'atar, the green za'atar. One of the most famous breakfast in Syria is like whenever you want to have breakfast, you would have two bowls, a bowl of za'atar and a bowl of extra virgin olive oil with flat bread. You dip first the flat bread with olive oil, and then you dip it in the next bowl with za'atar, and that's breakfast.
It really sounds wonderful. There's another blend that you've grown to love, a seven spice blend.
Yes. So this seven spice blend takes me back when I was at university studying at my university in Lebanon, at Beirut. I was living literally on top of, what do you call it, the roastery. They do coffee, but they also do have some spice blends. And every day I would wake up literally to the smells of coffee and spices from the roastery under my house. So I couldn't ask for more alarm clock every day. basically the seven spices, the blend is mainly from like black pepper, cloves, coriander seeds, and nutmeg, and of course cardamom and cinnamon. So all of those mixed together to a powdery kind of structure. And you can, so versatile, the seven blends, that you can use it in many dishes that can easily make any dish a very Syrian dish.
It's so delicious. You have a dish in the book that I've never seen before. I'm going to try and pronounce it. Horak osbal.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's actually a kind of special dish. It's also very much famous in Damascus and Aleppo. This dish, my mom never did it at home until I discovered it when I went to study in Lebanon. And one of my roommates was Syrian also, and his mom brought hurab osbal to him from Syria. And I tasted it and was like, oh my God, I have like wasted 20 years of my life.
So it's a lentil and pasta stew with tamarind and pomegranate.
Exactly, exactly. When you always, when you combine coriander and garlic and fry them with olive oil, this combination on top of what you just said and some lemon on top is just amazing.
Well, this has been such a delight. Thank you so much for staying up late with us after you fasted all day. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. And now it's almost like 11 p.m. here in Amsterdam, and you made me really hungry.
Anna Sitasi is the author of Sumac, Recipes and Stories from Syria. Fava beans find their way into my kitchen two ways, dried and fresh. Strangely enough, dried favas have much more in common with chickpeas. They're light brown and starchy, but with a softer texture. Fresh favas are a true seasonal treat, brilliant green with a flavor similar to limas, but less starchy. Jillian Ferguson is at the farmer's market in Santa Monica, where fresh green favas are at their peak.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week, where the spring produce just continues to show off. And I'm talking with Javier Espinosa, who is the chef de cuisine at the Luke Group. Javier has worked with Suzanne Goen for 18 years now, which is extraordinary. And he's what I would call a super regular at this market. Hi, Javier.
Good morning.
So today we are here to talk about fava beans, which seem to be everywhere at the market. I know they're on your menu. I would love for you to just talk us through the whole process of how they get from the market onto the menu at AOC, starting with shopping here and what you're looking for.
Yeah, so I guess when they first come to the market, they're a little bit small and a little hard to shuck. So we wait a little bit until they're like a medium to large size and then start buying them.
Okay, no, so you mentioned shucking, which is the key thing about fava beans. They have to be double peeled. They have to come out of the shell. And then the beans themselves are also wrapped in this tight sort of greenish gray skin. So do you shuck them, blanch them, and then peel off the skin? Or do you double shuck and then blanch?
We shuck them from their beautiful pod, and then blanch and shock in ice water. It makes it easier to pull them out of that extra layer of white skin.
All right, so once they're shucked twice, right, what happens to them at the restaurant?
So we then dry them once they're double shucked, and we gently stew them in lots of extra virgin olive oil, rosemary, garlic, and arbol chili, just until they're tender, a couple minutes. And we strain them, and then we put them in the food processor and make a puree and just process them until they're silky smooth. We add a little bit of that oil that we cooked them in. We season them in a little lemon juice, and we serve them on a dish right now at AOC, a big dollop of this puree alongside creme fraiche, a crunchy salad of pea shoots, watercress, radish, a little lemon juice. And then we drizzle charred scallion salsa with a little sherry vinegar olive oil, and we drizzle that over the top of the whole thing and serve it with a pumpernickel crostini.
Wow, that sounds like a perfect bite of spring.
It's so nice. So good.
Yes, this reminds me why we go out to eat, because to do all that at home would be quite a lot of work. Thank you.
Thank you, Jillian.
That was Javier Espinosa, chef de cuisine of the Luke Group. AOC is open for outdoor dining for both dinner and weekend brunch. They've got that gorgeous patio, and you can find the fava bean puree that we just talked about on the dinner menu. Mike Roberts is one of the farmers who brings favas to the market. Mike is a farmer with McGrath Family Farms up in Camarillo. And Mike, one of the magical properties of fava beans is that they are as nutritious for the soil as they are delicious for us to eat. Can you talk a little bit about why farmers like planting and growing favas so much?
It's a perfect rotational crop for us organic farmers, so it's in the legume family. We use it as a harvestable cover crop. In Southern California, the land is so expensive and such at a premium, it's very difficult to do a traditional cover crop, non-harvestable. So when we have something that we can actually harvest, bring to the market, and our customers and our restaurant partners love it, it's a very special crop family for us. So it's favas for us are the winter, spring legume.
Okay, and do you rotate which field you're planting them every year?
Absolutely. I wish I could tell you we have a very strategic rotation, but it's a lot of by farmer instinct, and we kind of know this went there, and now it's time for the favas or the limas or whatever season it is. So.
And I see them come to the market in different sizes, small, big, sometimes enormous.
Yes.
How do you like to pick them?
We pick them at all stages. So not only do we offer the baby fava bean, right? Some chefs want them that way or some customers want them that way, but also a full-size bean. We also shell the beans. We have an old-fashioned sheller on the farm where we run them through the sheller, and the fava tendril is also quite delicious, like a leafy green fava bean, and again, helps farmers with their economics. We have multiple crops we can harvest.
And when you're out in the field, can you snack on these favas? Can you eat them raw?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's how I eat my favas, raw in the field, just like I eat my pea tendrils as well.
And you're not double shucking them when you're eating them raw, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, never. Yeah, never. No. I always just do. As they get more mature, you want to do the double shuck. But when it's a younger, tender bean, you don't have to.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the business model at McGrath Family Farms, because Phil has done something really unique where he has created a collective of farmers. Tell us how it works.
So this is not a challenge that's unique to us, where a farmer is moving on in age and they're either retiring or passing on and there is no next generation coming behind them. So we're losing farmers. And what Phil has said to us, he said his longtime apprentices, the Carranza family, Paul Thurston, myself, he said, you all are the next generation of McGrath family farmers, and we're going to do this together. So over the last 5 to 7 years, we've been working through all the challenges you could imagine that come on with a transition like this. Many more voices at the table, farmers taking ownership of different sections of the land, but still all under Phil's mentorship umbrella. So it's been a wonderful process, very challenging, but we hope to share our findings so other farmers can at least consider this kind of succession plan to keep their farms and legacies going.
Yeah, and I think for us eaters, what I've noticed as a shopper here at the market is I just see more stuff on the table. You guys are bringing more and more types of products, and I imagine that comes from having so many voices.
That's a wonderful point, and thank you for recognizing that. It's a testament to these farmer apprentices. You're seeing the creativity of those farmers. You're seeing the diversity of those farmers. You're seeing all the different minds and hands and bodies. So I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it's very special to us. The farm is reflective of that, and now the booth is also reflective of that diversity.
Well, it's exciting to see all this transition and new life brought to the farm. Thank you so much, Mike.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That was Mike Roberts, a farmer with McGrath Family Farms. You can find them at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Thursday South Pasadena, Saturday in Santa Barbara, and Ojai and Hollywood markets on Sundays. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Up next, there should really be an award for surviving 20 years in the restaurant industry. It's a rare and special feat. When Good Food continues, we hear from Gino and Elizabeth Angelini, whose eponymous restaurant celebrates that milestone this year. There's a family tree with Italian roots in Los Angeles. For Gino Angelini's branch, Mauro Vincente is at the base, and Ori Menashe of Bavel and Bestia is the youthful limb. For those of us longing for a true taste of Italy and that feeling of gioia di vivere and sweet Italian hospitality, Angelini on Beverly Boulevard is a welcome pilgrimage spot. The restaurant, which celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, is the love child of husband and wife duo Gino and Elizabeth Angelini. It's the subject of this week's In the Weeds.
Hi, I'm Gino Angelini. I am the chef of the restaurant, the Osteria.
I am Elizabeth Angelini, and I am one of the co-founders of Angelini Osteria, and I am responsible for business relations.
I start very young, okay, because you know, we are poor family. We live you know, 18 kilometers in the countryside of Rimini, and my grandmother and my mother, they give me the dough, the pasta, the play. I play all the time with this. I have little container. I play a lot because I was all the time in the kitchen with my mother and my grandmother. At the time, the women staying home, they cooking all day. From the morning, the breakfast, lunch, the merenda in the not 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the dinner. They cooking all the time, and I was fascinated with this. And also, close to my house, he lived very, he was at the time very famous chef. I see, no, nice car, nice house, no, because my father and my old brother, they think I need to be in the military career, in the air flot. I said, no, I want to be the chef. I want to be, I fight, but I was 13 years and a half. I go to the cooking school in Rimini. My mother cried. I'd go 18 kilometers from my house. I said, oh, you leave the house. And when I start after, no, many of my friends, you tell, oh, you do it, the job, woman job, no, woman job, not the man. I don't care what we tell. I love doing this job because I love cooking. I love also eat, tell the truth. I started in Rimini in 1966 and 67. I do the cooking school. And in the summer, they send work in restaurant and the hotel. Rimini is famous for the birthplace of Federico Fellini. It was also famous for the discotheque. They call at the time, they called the small Miami, it was. The little Miami, they called Rimini at the time.
I met Gino in the late 1990s while he was in Los Angeles on a 3-month sabbatical, and I was immediately struck by how handsome he was and how funny and how sweet and incredibly energetic, and so we fell in love. And Gino was on a 3-month sabbatical working at Rex downtown, Mauro Vincenti's historic restaurant.
Mauro was very smart. He told me, okay, can you come in for 3 months? It was 2 or 3 years, he told me all this stuff, no? Come on, Gino, come in LA, stay 3 months. I said, yes, yes, but never I come. One day in Italy, I received a call. It was Mauro, said, okay, today we have the lunch in Modena. Fini was a famous restaurant with the bollito misto and all this stuff. I was in Val d'Aosta, I come in down, I arrived 2 o'clock. We have the lunch, late lunch together. He tell, this is the ticket. You have 2 days for prepare the, and you come in LA. I come in LA. I think I stay 3 months because I don't know one word in English. After 3 months, I talk with Mauro. I cry. I tell, I won't go back in Italy. And they tell, don't worry. You need to stay 6 months, 6 months. But no, the no Elizabeth, they change everything. I fall also on my heart. I encountered the love of my life. I'm still here.
And I was working in the computer industry, in high-tech industry. And even though Gino and I were doing two very different types of life, and he lived in Italy still, and I lived in America, we spoke 2 different languages, we decided that we wanted to get together. So Gino managed to come back to Los Angeles. And when he came back, I kind of followed my heart and followed Gino into the restaurant business. And that's how we started together. The Osteria was started in 2001. Gino's dream was to do an Osteria, which would be very communal and lively and full of conversation and lots of socializing, and also have what we considered very high quality food. So that was our objective, and that's what we started to do. And we were lucky that it worked in the sense that we attracted all types of guests, from major Hollywood celebrities to, you know, the neighbors who lived around the block and became very strong regulars. So we started doing what Gino wanted, which was good food at a good price. And Gino introduced many items on the menu that were more affordable, but yet true Italian and a little bit unique. You didn't find them everywhere, like the porchetta at the time, the tripe, the oxtail, and things like that. And then as it evolved, as time went by, more expensive, more gourmet items were making it to the menu, the white truffles, the Dover sole, you know, many of the items that the customers also enjoyed on special occasions. COVID has been a big struggle for our restaurant, but I do believe that we have come out of it stronger. We learned a lot of very valuable lessons about our agility and ability to adapt and to survive. Our team was determined to keep the restaurant open from the beginning. And actually, through the entire pandemic, we have not closed for one day. One of the difficulties of the pandemic has been not being able to sit closely together as we always did in the Osteria. Tables would start talking to one another. There was quite a sense of community, you know, having to be cautious with social distancing and everything that we had to do to follow the protocols. At the very beginning, when we opened for dining again, we felt we would never get our energy back, that it was really changed and perhaps forever. But little by little, the noise is coming back. And I think that there is a great pent-up demand for fun and for seeing people. And that's beginning to show in the ambiance at the restaurant.
Okay, so we come into the Osteria. I like the sea urchin pasta because it's with dry pasta. I like the pasta very al dente. The sea urchin is, we call it in Italian, il ricci di mare, no? The pasta is vissuté little shallot with gloved garlic crush and extra virgin olive oil. When they sauté, we put little white wine. We evaporate the white wine and put little lobster stock or fish stock. We boil it little and reduce. We put the sea urchin, take away from the burner, from the fire, and they come with the fork. We mix all the sea urchin with this little liquid and put little red chili, peperoncino, and parsley. And we cook in the pasta. We saute the pasta with this sauce. We put in the plate, in the top, we put one sea urchin raw and with little parsley or chives and little lemon juice, very little, a little extra virgin olive oil. This is our pasta.
That was Gino and Elizabeth Angelini. Their restaurant, Angelini Osteria, has been serving delicious Italian food on Beverly Boulevard for 20 years. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. And in honor of this week's show, look at your spice rack, freshen it up, and try something new that you've never tried before. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.